Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're going to be talking about, two interconnected things, which I really had not made as many connections as I was led to understand through looking at this fantastic couple of websites, all part of the Grace Communications Foundation. My guests today are Jerusha Klemperer, who is the director of Foodprint for the Grace Communications Foundation. She's also the host and producer of the What You Are Eating podcast. And her companion, Robin Maydell, is a senior research and policy analyst for the Water Footprint Project. And it was the Water Footprint Project, which I read about in, I don't know, it was now so long ago that I've forgotten where I saw it. But it's a fantastic tool in which you can calculate the amount of water you are consuming through your food stream. So first, let's talk a little bit about Grace Communications and what you both do there. And then we're going to talk about the story of the water calculator and how we should be using it. But Jerusha, why don't we start with you and what your role is at Grace?
Yeah, sure. So the Grace Communications Foundation is a family foundation that's dedicated to a variety of environmental issues, including those that are towards fighting for a better food system, you know, against the kind of predominant industrial food system that we have, and towards something more sustainable. And the foundation has a bunch of educational, external facing projects that are designed to educate students and consumers about issues around food and water, for example, that we're here to talk about today. So Foodprint is an editorial project of the foundation, and it's designed to help people understand the full impact of the food that they're eating on animals, on people, and on the planet. So looking at all of those animal welfare issues, environmental and social issues, and how our food impacts not just personal health, but also community health. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a website with all kinds of short white papers, longer reports, and then a lot of really nuts and bolts pragmatic stuff around how to shop and cook and eat more sustainably. But we really hope that people will dig in a little deeper past that to look at how these are systemic issues and how we can't quite shop and cook and eat our way out of a lot of these problems.
Yeah, that is so true. And Robin, tell us about the Water Footprint Project and the calculator.
Well, so back in about 2007, Grace wanted to start educating people about, it started with food, how much water food takes, but it expanded to how much water, basically how much water it takes to run our lives. And they became aware of the concept of, I was there then. We became aware of the concept of water footprints and put together a personal water footprint calculator. And what it incorporates is your direct use. So that's the water from a tap. That's the water that you see and feel that you can actually measure with a water meter. And also the water it takes, the virtual water it takes to make all of the food you eat, all of the consumer products you buy. So that's your clothing, your household goods, electronics, all of the energy you use. So that's electricity to keep your house warm or cool, but also all of the gasoline that you use. And then basically putting all of that together into a personal water footprint that brings it down to one person for one day and how much it takes for you to run your life in that one day.
And it's a staggering quantity, as I've discovered.
how did you do? Were you?
I don't even want to. It was embarrassing.
Well, so let me ask you this. When you took it, did you scroll down so you could see the breakout of how you use water so you could see all the individual values?
No, I didn't. I did it. I was much less thorough than I should have been for this.
Well, for people who do that, you actually can see that the majority of your water use comes through your food and through your other purchases, your household goods, you know, industrial water use. So it's basically all of your lifestyle choices. Yes. Direct water use is important. Yes. Direct water use conservation is important. But really, the big bulk of our water use comes through our diet, and it comes through the other parts of our life, our shopping.
Right, the consumer choices. I mean, that was the thing. You know, I, for example, I eschew having a lawn, even though I live in the country. So I basically just have a big patch of weeds. And I do have a garden, and I do water that. But as far as conserving water around the house, I'm pretty conservative. But I, you know, when I was confronted with all of the other choices, I was like, I don't even want to, because of course, I love clothes. So I buy clothing. Well, fast fashion, huge water consumption there, right? You know, things like that. That's where I was like, I just like shut down.
Yeah. Everybody has their breaking point with that thing.
It was painful.
Yes. Well, and if you think about even just with textiles, so, you know, some textiles are from agricultural products, cotton, rayon, et cetera.
Sure.
It takes water to grow cotton. And then a lot of the fast fashion is made with synthetic fabrics, and that's all oil. That's another way that oil companies get to use their products or sell us, get our money for their products is through fashion, because all those nylon, polyester fabrics are oil. They all are rooted in oil.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. Scary stuff. Yeah. So explain for the nerds, because I include myself in that. But, you know, when you broke out these categories, like, yes, you can personally sort of in your own head think to yourself, well, where am I wasting water? Do I need to flush the toilet every single time I use it, for example? Or how often do I run a load of laundry? Is it full when I run it? But there are all these other more industrial components. Like, how did you guys figure out how to break that down into sort of water versus other raw ingredients?
Right.
Was there a formula?
The direct water use is so much more concrete. You can actually understand it. So water footprints for items are in three components. There's the blue water footprint, the green water footprint, and the gray water footprint. The blue water footprint mostly pertains to crop items. And so it's the amount of water it takes to irrigate a crop. And it's from a reservoir or an aquifer. Green water footprint is the amount of rainwater it takes to... Oh, I'm sorry, I have that backwards. Green water mostly pertains to crops, because crops rely on... A lot of crops rely on rainwater.
Sure.
Where there's no rain, though, you have to rely on blue water in order to fulfill your needs. And likewise, where you run out of blue water, then you have to rely on rain, which, if you're in a drought, is a big problem. Then the third component is gray water footprint. And that is the amount of water. So all water use basically pollutes water. And a gray water footprint is the amount of water it takes to bring that water back to local pollution standards, drinking or not necessarily drinking water, but water treatment standards before it can be discharged into its receiving water body. And so, for example, when we say it takes a gallon of water to make one almond, there's a significant portion of that that is polluted water that would have to be diluted back to pollution standards as a part of that water footprint. And it's basically it's taking national water use numbers and bringing them down to a personal level.
I see.
National,
I think,
food use numbers as well, food consumption numbers.
Right, right. And that we can measure much more readily and easily.
Right, yeah. You can measure it based on retail sales and even even water use to some extent. You know how much water it takes to grow crops, and so you can estimate. It's a lot of estimating. Of course, you can never know specifically what your water footprint would be because you don't know how food is necessarily grown unless you grow it yourself, and you don't know how things are made. And also, let me just say this. Nobody should have a water footprint of zero. You're never going to get your water footprint at zero because we need water to exist. And that's not even the goal. The goal is don't waste it. Use it wisely in a way that's more sustainable. It's not to get people to zero.
Well, it's very interesting that, you know, we talk a lot about food waste nowadays, and I've certainly done quite a bit of programming around food waste, and we'll talk about that more with Jerusha in a minute. but I had never before seen anything like the water calculator and measuring a water footprint, and I just thought that was such a fantastic tool that people, that really makes it concrete. Like, when you waste a piece of food, you're not just wasting a piece of food, you're wasting what is amounts to, or what appears to be going to be, a finite resource. I, you know, I've been following water woes for the 12 years I've been doing this podcast, and it's, you know, it's shocking and astonishing how rapidly the drought has escalated, how climate change has affected snowpack in the West, and especially what we're seeing out in this long-term drought in the West. Like, I was going to ask you about whether or not there were any credible predictions about when the West is going to go dry. You know, now that we're seeing all these terrifying photographs of Lake Mead and Lake Powell and finding, you know, Jimmy Hoffa's remains all over the place, like, you know, like, this is preeminent, as it turns out. It's not something that's going to happen in 2050. It's going to be happening right away. So what are there any credible predictions that you have come across?
You know, they can predict. It just, it depends on how wet of a year you end up getting, because even if you look at the, I sent you a link for the U.S. Drought Monitor. That's an excellent way to monitor.
Oh yes. I didn't look at that yet. Yeah.
Drought in your state. And it's, if you look at the last 4 years, look at July, you can see that 4 years ago, most of the country was not in a drought, or if they were, it was a, like a level one dry. It wasn't drought. And then 4 years later, a significant portion of the country is in extreme drought. And and so it happens. There is this concept called stationarity, which says that you can predict the future based on events in the past. And for water, it's dead. That concept is dead. It died a decade ago. And we really can't, you know, they can look at weather patterns and say, we're going to be in a La Nina or an El Nino, and then that's going to have this impact or that impact on how much water falls. But ultimately, they don't know until they get there and they're actually standing measuring snowpack, or they're looking at river flows, how much they're going to have. And so I think the consensus is that we may start seeing Lake Mead hitting Deadpool, where water can't make it down below the lake because it's below the outfall level, starting in a couple years. It may hit that and then it'll rise and then it'll go down and it'll rise. And I haven't seen a prediction of when Lake Mead could go completely dry, because I don't think anybody can say that they know that. I think it's a wait and see kind of a thing. It's almost becoming like a year or every 2 year kind of a planning window. I can't imagine what it's like being a water planner out in the West right now.
Well, me either. And then there are all those arcane water rules and, and legislation that, you know, emerged in the late 19th, early 20th century that are governing the way water is used. And nobody seems to be getting a grip on revising those regulations. And then there's also the fact that land in Arizona and other dry areas has been planted out to alfalfa and other, you know, cotton, other water intensive crops. And, you know, where's that water supposed to come from?
So what happened was in the 80s and the 90s, they were a couple of particularly wet decades. And that also happened to be when the Colorado River Compact was being written and decided. So all the states were agreeing, all the states plus Mexico were agreeing to how much water everybody gets based on unusually high levels of river flow. And now those river flows don't exist anymore. So it's automatically already over allocated. Plus you add a mega drought on top of that and the water's just not there. And we're growing crops, watering crops in a desert with dwindling water resources.
Well, what I mean, we can talk more about this, and Jerusha, I certainly hope you'll comment on it. But you know, the implications on food security and national security are so big when it concerns water. And I just wondered if you had any comment on that, on like, you know, is somebody paying attention to this beyond sort of the immediate victims of extreme drought? Like, is there a national policy that is being debated, or do you feel like legislators are paying attention?
I think.
What's your read on that?
So here's the thing. First of all, there's no Department of Water. If you think about it, it's all split out between EPA and BLM and even DOE to some extent. They do some water and energy stuff, but there's no centralized Department of Water. And we don't have national water legislation beyond the Clean Waters Act. And you see the efforts to try to revise that with Waters of the U.S. legislation that keeps getting batted around between the Congress and the courts. And they keep going back and forth between it's up to the states. No, it's up to the feds. No, it's up to the states. It's up to the feds. Mm-hmm. States typically will take responsibility there are federal regulations that govern quality, but in terms of water use, states will take responsibility for regional controls and less often on local controls. Where they tend to do it more is in terms of groundwater use, because when aquifers get drawn down, that water in a lot of cases is gone because it's not easily recharged. But they're less... They seem to be, they revert to the water rights system for water use conflicts at the state level. And of course, you know, in the West, it's all prior appropriation where I got here first, so I have the water right.
Versus
in the East Coast where it's, you know, I have this land that has water, so I get a fair use of it or an equal use of it beneficial use, I think is the term. I think how it affects national security is internationally, where we see places like in Central America, they struggle a lot with drought, and that causes a lot of climate refugees and migration. And where do they go? They want to come to the U.S. And this country has a hard time with refugees, and we don't have an overarching immigration policy that says based on climate, here are the actions to take. You know, it's a lot that we have a lot of work to do to address this. And so in terms of national security, I think in our future, we're going to see a lot more climate migration and climate refugees that are knocking on our door saying we need help. And we are going to have to figure some things out about.
We're going to send them up to Canada, Robin, aren't we?
And here, so, you know, and here's the thing, like water's connected to so much. If Lake Mead runs low, then they have trouble producing power. And so Las Vegas gets power shortages, and then factories can't produce because factories use a lot of water. Industrial operations take a lot of water, and then people lose their jobs. If they have to shut down because they don't have water, people don't have jobs. And then
that's right.
It's this all connected kind of a, it's a web. And it's, I know you had asked about the Nexus. We can talk about that in a while, but
we're going to talk about that after this break. Yeah. We're going to take in just a second. In fact, let's take the break right now. And then I want you both to weigh in on the water, food, energy nexus, or food, water, energy nexus, because I thought that was fascinating. And then Jerusha will talk a little bit more about food print. So stay tuned. We're going to be right back after this sponsor drop with Jerusha Klemperer, Robin Madel from the Grace Communications Foundation, talking about your foot and water prints. I mean, your food and water prints.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
All right. So we were talking before the break about the food, water, energy nexus. What does that mean? And why do we need to pay attention to it?
Briefly, the food, water, energy nexus is the way that our food system, our water system, and our energy system all connect and hopefully achieve balance.
Right.
If you're paying attention, you know that that's probably not usually the case, but the systems influence each other. And here's how. It takes a lot of water to make food. It takes a lot of water to make energy. So if you're making thermoelectric power using natural gas or coal, or even, you know, concentrated solar or whatever, however you're making that energy, you're probably boiling water to turn a turbine. And that water water gets heated up and has to be cooled down. And then it takes a lot of water to cool that water down, and a lot of it gets evaporated and it's lost to the system. Also, a lot of water movement takes energy because you're using pumps. And when you're treating water, you're using electricity to run treatment systems.
Yes.
So there's that connection there. There's a connection between food and energy, because a lot of crops are now grown to become biofuels, whether that's
like corn,
corn, soy, palm. It also takes a lot of energy to grow food in the form of fertilizer that has its origins in natural gas. So you start to see how all of these things connect. And when you talk about food waste, you're wasting all of those resources in addition to seeds, labor, money, animals.
Yeah. It's breathtaking. Yeah. So Jerusha, let's talk a little bit, now that we've broken that down, let's talk about the food print. You know, how does that help us understand the food, water, energy nexus better?
Yeah, well, I think one of the main things that Foodprint is trying to convey to the average eater is that all of these things are connected, right? And that's all of the major problems from our food system have come from kind of breaking a holistic system apart into different elements and then being shocked, right, that they've that everything is disrupted, you know? So you, like the kind of typical thing would be, you know, you look at a place like Iowa, where you've totally decoupled hog production and crop production, right? So whereas you used to have a small hog farm and there would be some corn and some wheat growing and various other maybe vegetables, and then you would raise some pigs and the pigs' manure would fall on the ground and fertilize the soil that would then grow this wheat and corn and other maybe vegetables. And then the hogs will eat some of that. And then it's this closed loop. And then now you have a state where you've broken those two things apart from each other. And you just have swaths of land dedicated to growing corn and soy and swaths of land dedicated to huge factory farms where you raise pigs separate from where those crops were, and then are like, oh no, what do we do with all of their poop? Because you're not anywhere near the fields and the scales are inappropriate and not aligned. And that's the main thing we're trying to teach people about on Foodprint is what an integrated and holistic system looks like and what one where everything has been broken apart looks like and how you end up with these negative impacts when you break things apart.
Right, right. I mean, the thing is that I, much as I deplore factory farming, I don't really see how we will reverse the trend that you've just described. And the way we have, you know, the corn lobby has so successfully indoctrinated everybody into thinking that biofuels, ethanol from corn and soy is going to somehow save us on fossil fuel. You know, it's just the interlocking of these sort of essentially capitalist, profit-driven industries has resulted in this disconnect from what is in fact going to be able to preserve our land and water resources for the future. And I don't see how we're going to uncouple that. Do you? Like, I mean, I'd love to think that we could go back to, and I think like in an area where I am in New England, where we're working, you know, a lot of states are working hard to re-regionalize the food system. Out in Iowa and the Corn Belt, the Grain Belt, I don't see that happening. And I'm wondering, you know, this is just, of course, going off topic because that's how I roll. But how are we going to revise that system to reflect something that's a little healthier for the environment and by extension for the human race? What are your thoughts about that, Jerusha? You've been in this game a long time now.
I mean, it's hard not to be extremely pessimistic. I would start by saying that, like, oh no, we will solve this with, you know, small local food systems. I'm depressed about it. And it's hard to disagree with what you're saying. It does feel like, you know, watching like the climate legislation that's starting to get pushed through, that the only thing that will make any difference in all of this is when we totally run out of water, when we, you know, Our daily temperatures get so high and so unlivable that everyone is scared. So I would say the sad thing is that things have become so impossible to ignore. You know, that the effects of climate change are being felt even in the most privileged parts of the world. You know, and seeing those pictures that you mentioned of lakes that people picture as, you know, full to the brim and then they're empty in a matter of years. These are the only things that are going. If anything has the power to change anything, these are the only things. And whether it's too late, potentially yes. But that's the only thing I ever see as having the potential to make a difference is because these companies and these lobbies see like, well, we won't exist anymore. This is an existential threat to our existence as a profit making. Right.
Industry. Well, it's interesting to me that, you know, and people who listen to my show for a long time have heard this a million times, but I say it to everybody. It's the Reagan-Thatcher era is what really Yeah, sort of boiled us along, you know, deregulating industry, allowing monopolies and consolidation, rolling back regulations on, you know, quality, air quality, water quality, et cetera. I mean, all of that stuff, and basically taking the profit over people approach that has characterized the last 50 years in this country and around the world. Globalization, neoliberalism, all of that stuff.
Dark money that and is politics.
All, yeah, right. It's all comes from that particular era in the 70s and 80s when none of this stuff was even really on the horizon, right? Like nobody thought we'd run out of water. And, you know, I mean, they knew it was going to happen, but somehow all of that information was suppressed. You know, and basic consumers didn't get that memo. What they got, cheap food. And boy, oh boy, when you start rolling those prices back up to what the real cost of production is, when you include the externalities that we are paying for through our tax dollars into our food costs, that's when you're going to see some revolution around here, in my opinion. But I want to talk a little bit about the fantastic stuff that is on your Foodprint website, because you have all of these very data-rich reports, and you mentioned them in your introduction at the top of the show, but you have these like short papers on the footprint of food packaging, the footprint of fork, the footprint of my favorite, fake meat, or what the industry likes to call meat alternatives, which I think is the biggest boondoggle of them all. I really want to know who's making the money on that stuff. I want to hear a little bit about how you do the research and put those reports together, because that is a truly rich mine of information for consumers who want to understand more about the food system.
Absolutely. So most recently, I would say some of our earlier reports, we were writing with various different researchers. Currently, we have someone on our team who's a food research and policy analyst who researches and writes these reports, except the Footprint of Fake Meat, we co-wrote that one together, mm-hmm. he and I. But yeah, you can see looking at the footnotes for these reports, I mean, it's like hundreds of footnotes, basically yes. pulling from all of the good data and all of the really excellent journals and news articles that have been put out on all of these topics. So there's no new reporting, as it were, in any of these reports. They're simply like a culling of the best research out there.
Right.
They do have a point of view, of course. We are a mission-driven organization. And, you know, when we write a report on pork, we are going to write in great detail about the problems with factory farms and with the way that the majority of pork production happens in this country, and then also talk about what it looks like when you do it a better way. So mm-hmm. they all really have a point of view, but they're highly footnoted so that you can see the statistics, you know, of what this environmental ruin looks like, what it looks like when you destroy local communities, you know, when Smithfield builds up hog CAFOs all over Eastern North Carolina, what it looks like for those communities and what it looks like when they fight back.
Sure.
So we really try to include the whole footprint of these foods and then offer people guidance on like, well, how can you help support a better system? What are the laws and at play here? What are the labels that you can look for? All that kind mm-hmm. of stuff.
Right, right. I mean, I have become firmly convinced over the course of doing this work for all these years that the only thing that is really going to change the system is some kind of legislation and finding politicians who are willing to stand up to lobbies and make rules that benefit the farmer, benefit, you know, the animal husbandry, whatever, you know, part of agriculture you're working in, that all has to happen before any of this stuff is going to change. But so do you see, like, there are some states that really actually target food and water waste to a certain extent, and some are not. But I'm going to go back to that federal issue of, like, have you seen any movement? Like Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren's have been very active in trying to, you know, demonopolize and have introduced a couple of bills to demonopolize, say, the animal agriculture industry. Do you see other legislative initiatives being brought forward that might serve as a kind of a blueprint for states to follow and for, you know, or is that happening in other countries that we could follow? What's your sense of sort of the global approach to some of these problems that pretty much every developed country is facing to one extent or another?
I mean, you sort of touched on some of that anti-consolidation stuff, and I think that that is hugely important, and nothing will happen without it. And whether or not we're going to be able to push this, any of this stuff through, is another question. But you also mentioned waste, some of the waste around, and that was where we started. So I can just look at this, you know, this issue of food waste, which can feel or sound kind of small if you haven't learned a bit about it, but then you realize that it is actually quite big.
Yeah, give us a sense of that. I did mean to give you that opportunity to talk about food waste.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
please do.
You know, we in this country, we're wasting 40% of the food that we produce. So when you look at this problem of resources, we've talked about, you know, how much water it takes, all of the pollution, all of the environmental impacts and
the
animal welfare impacts and all and the
right.
energy and also how many people are food insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say we're wasting 40% of it. That's a kind of heartbreaking statistic. And generally, you know, we've touched a bunch of times on this in this conversation already about how many things are like we can't make a personal difference necessarily. The legislation has to change. They have to break up the monopolies. They have to. Food waste is wild because each of the, you know, the average for a household is that on the household level, just to be confusing, that 40% statistic comes up again, but 40% of the food that we have in our homes, we are wasting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's huge in terms of that you can make a personal difference because it's not just a waste of all those resources. It is not just a waste of our personal finances, but also when this food ends up in landfill, it emits methane. So it's
right.
contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. It's contributing to climate change. So when we look at climate change mitigating possibilities, reducing food waste is actually a huge opportunity. And looking in our own homes and making changes in our own home can actually make a huge dent. Now, obviously, food is being lost and wasted every step along the chain, but it's also being lost in our households. And that's something we can work on personally. However, there are also things that can happen legislatively. And unfortunately, there's not much happening at a federal level. I mean, even something as simple as the Food Date Labeling Act, because would have been extremely helpful, and it died in committee. And even though everyone was like, that sounds like a good idea. It seemed to have like bipartisan support, seems like a really easy win. And even that didn't happen. But food date labeling is important because a lot of the loss that happens at a retail level and at a household level is because people have confusion about what does Best Buy mean? What does a sell by mean?
Right.
Like, this is probably expired, right? I shouldn't eat it. And people rightfully have concerns about food safety, so they're throwing stuff away. But if we had sort of codified date labeling where people could understand that they were all the same and that this just meant, you know, after this date, smell it. Like, see
right.
what you think.
If it tastes
you know?
Bad, don't eat it.
Right. Like that would be extremely helpful. But even that couldn't pass. So the most promising thing is stuff that's happening on a statewide level. So there are a bunch of statewide laws already in action or, you know, about to be enacted in various states around the country, things to keep food out of landfills. And in some cases, those laws are directed mostly at institutions.
Yeah.
You know, so saying like restaurants and schools and this and that, whatever, are not allowed to put food waste in the trash.
Mm-hmm.
Like they have that. It's called the Universal Recycling Law in Vermont. New York State recently passed this, just the ban for institutions. Sorry, the Vermont one is for individuals, for homes as well. But in Rhode Island and New York State, you've got ones that say institutions are not
That's
allowed.
Right.
You have to get your food waste into the compost stream. So California course is like out ahead on this. So the more and more states we can get on board with this, the better, because it doesn't seem like anything like this is happening at a federal level.
At the federal level. We only have a couple minutes left. I want you guys to get a chance to talk about some of the educational initiatives that Robin let me know you guys are pursuing in terms of working with educators, developing content modules to help explain some of these concepts to younger kids, because after all, this is going to be their world. So they should learn early about this stuff. So can you just quickly give us an idea of what some of the products that you are able to pump out to educators if they're interested, and how educators could learn more about that?
Absolutely. So what we realized initially, we were marketing the calculator to kind of the general public consumers. And we realized along the way that we really wanted to get to young people. And the way to get to young people is through teachers. And so we changed our strategy and started educating teachers. We started marketing to teachers, educating teachers, and it's been really effective. We've had nearly 4 million people complete the calculator. Make it all the way through. And it's, I think I figured it out today, we're at almost 3.7 million completions.
That is fantastic.
And it's really encouraging because I know, like, I've talked with students who are working on projects, and, you know, I can see the light bulb going on. I'll tell them everybody uses water. There's no reason for you to be wasting water. And for example, if you're standing in your shower doing anything other than washing your hair or your body, let's say you're planning out your day, or you're in the shower at the end of the day reflecting on your day, you're wasting water. And you can see the light bulb go on as they go, oh yeah, I do that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a little place to start. But then they also start seeing in terms of their food use or food waste. And so what we put together is a series of lesson plans for two grade bands, that three lesson plans per grade band that touch on, first of all, what a water footprint is, the water footprint of our food, and then kind of the water footprint of their school. So it offers teachers an opportunity to work with students to do a survey of their school and look at how they're using water in the school. And they've been very popular. They've been, we have everything on our site is free, and a lot of it is downloadable. The lesson plans are all downloadable, and we've had a lot of downloads on it. And it really is an attempt to get them to have a more holistic picture of how they're using water. Because if they don't understand saying water use beyond the tap, water and food, it's so abstract. And if they don't understand what that means, it's never going to land with them. And so these lesson plans are a way to make the concepts of how they use food and how they use water through food very concrete.
Right. And then as they get older, they can pursue other, they can do that whole food, water, energy nexus.
Exactly.
You know, where you see how the clothing choices you make, the appliance choice you make, the, you know, paper that you're, I mean, all of that stuff.
Well,
just breathtaking.
And there's actually another set of lesson plans produced by Johns Hopkins called Foodspan that you might be interested in. And they actually address a lot of those other issues that Foodprint addresses at middle and high school educational level. So they're also bringing those concepts to a more concrete level. And it's, I mean, we started doing this, we put the lesson plans up, I don't know, 3 years ago, but we really started appealing to teachers when we redid our whole site in 2015. And that's when we really changed our focus to teachers. So it hasn't even been a decade. And so those students from middle and high school are just becoming adults with purchasing power. And so we'll see, you know, they hopefully have it in their brains that these choices that they are making for their families, for themselves and their families or households, have implications.
Right. And implications for society as a whole, in addition to their own personal stuff.
That's right.
We're going to have to wrap it up here, but I want people to understand how and where they can learn more. So Jerusha, Foodprint, where do they learn about that?
Sure. www.foodprint.org.
Okay, that's easy. And the water calculator, Robin?
www.watercalculator.org.
Okay, ladies, that could not be simpler, people. It couldn't. I mean, do the water calculator thing. It's It's painful and eye-opening in ways that I highly recommend for. And the footprint stuff is also really fascinating. I mean, just reading, you know, through a few of those papers, I wrote a book about the meat industry. I mean, I've really immersed myself in that topic, and even I learned some stuff. So really well done. This is all on the Grace Communications Foundation website, correct?
So people can find links to this from there. Yeah.
Yeah. So people can learn more about what's happening at Grace and more about, you know, the other projects that you guys are involved in. But I so appreciate your time today. I hope you'll come back. This is a wonderful conversation. There's a lot to unpack here, a lot to talk about. Really appreciate your time today. And I wish you the best for the rest of the week. And thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to people for tuning in. Thanks to my sponsors, as always. See you next time, folks. Have a good one.
What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.